Hello, it's me, Sam Dunnewald. I'm here before the show to tell you that I am kickstarting my first standalone in-print RPG, Band-Aids and Bullet Holes. It's a John Wick-inspired game of bloody revenge inside a tight-knit clique of professional assassins. It's a one-shot capsule game, box set, deck builder, and it's the end result of 3 years of interviews and ideation on all things game design right here on Dice Exploder. If you like the show, if you like how I think about game design, I think you're really going to love this game. I really just want you to know about it. I want you to play it. And you can follow the Kickstarter page right now at a link in the show notes. You can back the game starting May 5th. That's it. Thanks so much for listening, as always. I hope you check out the game. Here's Dice Exploder. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Dice Exploder. Each week, we take a tabletop mechanic and never forget its acquaintance. My name is Sam Dunnewald, and my co-host today is Kim Lamb. Today, we're wrapping up the Dice Exploder series on love, sex, and romance. Our summer of love is coming to a close. It may have flown by so quickly, but that's summer flings for you. And while we're doing send-offs, I think this episode is also a great send-off to the LARP series from earlier this year, because when I asked Kim what romance thing she wanted to talk about, she picked the LARP Will That Be All by Graham Walmsley, a game about the social relationships between the downstairs staff at Melton Hall, a fictional British estate, over the course of about a decade between the First and Second World Wars, over the course of three New Year's Eves over about a decade between the First and Second World Wars. It's a lovely game about finding solace and community, even as the world outside feels deeply uncertain. Sounds familiar. And that's what Kim wanted to talk about. How setting, and in this case, the specter of war, can encourage and affect how not just romance, but relationships of all kinds can play out in a game. And it connects to Kim's latest game, Letters from the Front, which is about another wartime situation, where two women, one Japanese and one Canadian, are writing letters to each other across the ocean. And I think a lot of the threads from my LARP series come up as well. So let's get into it. Thanks to everyone who supports Dice Exploder on Patreon. And with that, here is Kim Lamb with Will That Be All and The War. Kim Lamb, thanks so much for being here on Dice Exploder.
Happy to be here.
It's such a pleasure. What are we talking about today?
So we will be talking about Will That Be All, which is a LARP for 6 to 10 players about servants living in Melton Hall, which is sort of a stereotypical British manor house. And it takes place in the 1920s, 1930s, so as war is approaching, and it's about their relationships. So each act, and there's three of them, takes place on New Year's Eve, a few minutes before midnight, and it's just kind of a chance for them to find connection and love.
Yeah, it is like downstairs of Downton Abbey only, doing as much romance as possible between two great wars is what it feels like for me having read it.
Yes. So what's okay? I've never actually watched Downton Abbey.
Neither have I actually. So
yeah. So I almost never pitch it as, oh, it's downstairs only of Downton Abbey, because I haven't. Yeah. Like, I haven't engaged with that particular show. But everyone who I pitch it to goes, oh, Downton Abbey. I'm like, yeah, okay. And then after they play it, like, yeah, totally. So I guess so.
Yeah, great.
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
Listen, we'll use the touchstone because it's quick and snappy.
right.
So flavorfully, that's the setup for the game. Mechanically, this is a LARP. Honestly, if you've come out of the LARP series that I did earlier this year and you are listening to this and looking for a fun little 6 to 10 person LARP to play, I think this is a great choice to get started with.
Mm-hmm.
What mechanically is going on in this game? Like, what do you do as players?
Okay, so the game is broken up into three acts, 1928, 1931, and 1935. You start by picking your characters, and each character is really short. It gives a name, it gives an age, what servant role you have.
So do you want to like take one of these character cards and just read it aloud? They're so short for
us. Yeah, sure. Okay, let's talk about James, the second footman. He's 28 years old. In 1911, you joined Melton Hall as a hall boy, working your way up to footman. You were too sickly to go to war, but losing friends left you wary of authority. You like politics and read the paper avidly. You make money by having sex with visitors, male and female. If you found the right person, you'd stop this and get married.
Yeah, great. So you're James, and then you move into this second part of character creation, which involves relationship questions?
Sort of. Okay, so I love these prompts. In every act, there are sort of prompts. You lay them all out, and everyone picks one. So in the first act, all of the prompts are about feelings you have towards other characters. And specifically, they're very, like, fulsome, joyful, exciting feelings in the first act.
Yeah, I feel an urge to protect you.
Yeah. And okay, what's great about this is that right now you have spent 2 minutes picking a character. You know a little bit about this character, but nothing really else. And then suddenly you're picking this prompt card, and it tells you that you have big, exciting feelings about someone else. But it also tells the other person that someone has big, exciting feelings about them.
Yeah, I was going to say this same thing. Yeah.
Right? And doesn't it feel kind of great to have someone, like, even if your character doesn't know, but you secretly kind of know that someone feels a burning passion for you? Like, that's fun.
Well, the other thing I love about this is it reminds me of the King is Dead character creation, where you have a character and you say what, like, Game of Thrones style house your character is from. And so that gives you a, like, stereotype of personality that your character can play off of. And then you go around and every other player tells you one adjective that their character would use to describe you. And, like, if someone describes you as beautiful, either you can take that and be like, oh, well, I'm beautiful. Or you can take it and be like, I'm really not beautiful, but this, like, says something really interesting about my relationship with that person. And since character is so much like how characters relate to each other, like, I think character is relationships.
Right.
The fact that you can take the fact that someone has an urge to protect you and say, oh, I am someone who, like, is putting out that energy, or I really dislike that and I'm playing against that. Like, it gives you a lot of control over what you want to do and how you want to frame your character, even as it's giving you something good to push off of.
Yeah. And it gives you something to sort of, like, build off of when you're in the game. Like, you're walking into the slarp, you've got so little to work with, but it's not, like, too much to juggle. Right. Yeah. Like, if all you have to remember is, I don't know what to do, I feel a burning passion for Cress, I'm gonna talk to her in a very intense sort of way and we'll see what happens.
Yeah. So, okay, so we do this first act. I'm James. I have the urge to protect someone. I tell that person that that's how I feel about them. And then what happens?
Okay, so actually, I'm going to back you up a little bit.
Please.
Because you decide a few things about your servants' hall, right? Because that's where the game is going to be taking place. And it means that you can sort of customize it to the players. And it tells you a little bit something about what the servants are used to, sort of their special place. And it tells each other shared things that you can use in the game.
Do you have an example?
So in one game that I played in, we had a secret nook that was hidden, I think, above the fireplace. And you had to pull out a stone and we would hide things in there. And much later in the game, that was where I got the wedding ring to propose to one of the other characters. I ran off to like the cook and I was like, do we have a ring in the nook? And she's like, hold on. Yes, we do. We do. I'm like, great. Wish me luck. Ah!
Yeah. That's fun.
Yeah.
Just kind of setting up that stuff.
Yeah. And it gets people, like, used to collaborating with each other, right? Making up details with each other. It's just a little bit of practice, which is really nice. And then there's a little blurb about the setting and the time and the war and where the war is at. And I find it really interesting that you hear about the setting after you've made all the character stuff. Right?
Interesting.
And this happens in every other act. You hear about what's happening in the world at large after you've done the prompts.
Yeah. Which is kind of how it works in real life, too. Like, I'm living my life. I have my relationships with my friends and my loved ones. And then I get a news alert.
Right. Yeah. Well, and I also think that we'll probably talk about it a lot later. It lets you use the war and what's happening in the world at large as a metaphor and as a stand-in for other things you might want to talk about.
Yeah.
Right?
Okay, let's come back to that in a second, because if I didn't make it clear in my intro, the thing that we're talking about today is the setting and is the war.
Yeah.
But I want to get through, like, so we do all this setup, and then it's 11 p.m. on New Year's Eve on the year in question, and we just role-play for an hour, half an hour
It's about 45 minutes-ish.
Okay.
I have both facilitated without playing, and I have played while facilitating. It works both ways. You just have to have, like, a timer. It's fine.
Yeah,
you play for 45 minutes or so. The end of the night is called. I like to use an audio file of the grandfather clock ringing.
Oh, sure.
Right, because then it goes for like 12 and everyone's like, oh, it's time.
Yeah.
And then we move on to the next act. So second act is very similar to the first, except now the prompts, the feelings are a little more uncertain. They're questioning. They're wondering about change. Same thing with the setting. It's 1931. And rumblings of war again. There's political strife going on. The game doesn't actually go into any detail about it. And that's actually, I think, on purpose. because we're not trying to bog everyone down with like historical details necessarily. Play another round. It's New Year's Eve, about 45 minutes. Grandfather clock goes off. And in the last act, instead of having feelings, it's a question about the future.
Yeah.
And these are great. So it's something like, would you desert me if times got tough?
Yeah.
Right. And
we all know times are getting tough.
Times are getting tough, right?
Yeah.
And what I find really fascinating about this part in Act 3, you do the prompts, then you find out that this is your last night in Melton Hall. It's being requisitioned by the army as a training center. So the family is moving on. Your services are no longer required. This is your last night.
Which is, again, like how it would feel in real life, right?
Yep.
Like you would start having these questions. The war is coming. You're learning about that. You know that's coming because like that was kind of in the background in 1931. And now we're like jumping forward 4 years. And now like I'm starting to wonder, like, would you desert me if times were tough? And then we find out this is our last night in Melton Hall.
Yeah. And I like that order. Because again, it keeps everything sort of focused on what people are dealing with internally, like the important stuff that's going to be coming up in the game. But it still allows, like, we're leaving tomorrow. The war is coming. I'm now feeling pushed, incentivized to follow up on these feelings instead of letting them lie for the next year or whatever.
Totally. The school is ending, right?
You gotta
ask out your crush before it ends.
Incredibly important. And I have run this game many times, and whenever I read that card out, it hits. When players find out, wait, what? Even though they know it's the last act of the game and they know the game is going to end, that setting detail like really hits them in the heart.
Yeah. It's so interesting because it's not like all the characters are dying.
Yeah.
You know, like you're going to like be able to do in some kind of epilogue, like, OK, we go and get a nice house in the country and settle down together or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But like it still feels like an ending because it is an ending, and endings always feel a way.
Yeah.
Okay, so the mechanic we are here to talk about today is the setting. We're already kind of getting into this, but I want to step back before we get into the like specifics of this and also talk about the setting of like when the game was coming out, like the context that the game was being released into. So it sounds like maybe you were there. I was certainly not, and I would love to hear from you what that was like.
Okay, so back in my day when I walked uphill both ways in the snow to get to school.
In the age-old year of 2015.
Anything prior to the pandemic now feels like it was 12,000 years ago. Anything during like the G+ era feels like it was 20 years ago. So a lot of the things that we take for granted now were new and exciting then, right? Like maybe Monster Hearts was out. Like Powered by the Apocalypse had been published, I think, 2010?
Yeah.
Something
I'm
like that.
I'm pretty confident.
Yeah. So this was like a wild world of experimenting with like Powered by the Apocalypse stuff. The LARP scene in North America was being hit by all the Nordic LARP things. Like Lizzie Stark had come back and was talking about Jeep Form and everything else. And everyone was like, wait, hold on. LARP can be like, what? I imagine Graham knew more about it, given that he lives in the UK. But anyways, and we take for granted that Drive Through Cards has existed for years and years and years. And it had just opened in like early 2010s, somewhere in there, right? So the idea of first a LARP that was written for a deck of cards was kind of new and exciting. The idea that small form LARPs were kind of a thing was gaining traction. And like there were definitely pockets of it happening all over the place, but it wasn't just this like, yeah, of course, obviously.
Yeah.
The way it is now. Romance games weren't, yes, of course, at the time. Like there just weren't that many. Was it Breaking the Ice had been written like 10 years before, but there was a lot of pushback against it. Like it took years for it to really gain steam, and it was one of the few notable romance games. And now we have so many of them, right?
What was that pushback like? Like I assume that was just coming from like trad D&D dudes being like, romance, all I want to do is sleep with the bar wench, like kind of like misogynist crap. But I don't know. Like,
there was definitely a certain amount of pushback against, that idea of, well, what's the point? Why would anyone want to do romance in a game? I would feel weird GMing a romance with my friends. That feels a little taboo. Oh, of course, a woman would want to talk about romance. What's the point?
Sure.
Right. There's definitely a lot of that sort of thing going on. And
honestly, I mean, like, to talk about romance a little bit, like, I feel that way about it, just complimentary. Like I do think it's like a little taboo, a little exciting. It feels a little dangerous to flirt with your friends. And like,
yeah.
But like in a way that is fun and safe when everyone's on board with it.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah, I think there was also a certain amount of pushback on the idea that you could mechanize a romantic situation in any particular way, right? Like, I don't know if it's fair to say, like, well, like, you know, leave that to role-playing, not role, R-O-L-L, play, you know, that sort of thing.
And yet people have been out here trying to seduce the bartender since the very first games of Dungeons & Dragons, so...
Right, yeah. So, like, it was a little funny for me to, like, think back on, like, what was it like back then? Like, I used to write for this website called Gaming as Women. It's actually defunct now, but we actually started it in large part because there were a bunch of us getting together being like, there's really no place where we talk about what it's like to be women in gaming and topics of importance to us, including the things we like in games, which is basically everything, the logistics about putting together a game, which like a lot of the time it was the GM's girlfriend who had to figure out food and like clean the house and all this other stuff, right? And yeah, these days it's like, yeah, everyone talks about it. And there are people who are like, why are we still talking about it? And that's just like a whatever kind of thing, as opposed to people legitimately like pushing, like it being part of the dialogue, being like, no, this is a conversation we should be having. Right.
Yeah.
Now there's just a lot of other voices who are just taking that up as given, which is kind of nice.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's kind of what it was like back then. So when I went to play this game, I think it was at Metatopia. It was fresh and exciting and new and like nothing I'd ever really engaged with before.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, cool. All right, so let's get into the war and specifically like how the war affects the act of romance or the stakes of romance
in this
game. Like, I find this really interesting. Like, the stakes of this game are clearly romantic. Like, how are you going to feel about other people? How are they going to feel about you? And I feel like highlighted there in the game are romantic relationships. But there's also this community sense, right? Like, the ultimate end of the game is not just, like, the hall is closing. What does that mean for James and whoever he has developed a relationship with? But also, like, the whole community of servants and the family that they have been serving. Like, what is going to happen to that community?
Right.
And the war clearly imposes on all of that. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I'd love to hear you start from, like, what do you find interesting and most notable and powerful about this?
Okay, so we are talking about the war, right?
Even though
this game takes place between two very significant wars, and while the game is going on, there are like little wars all over the world and that sort of thing, but there's no actual war. So my contention is that in this game, we're not talking about the war or any particular war per se. We're talking about the mythic war, the setting piece that we will pull things from to use as we need in order to give depth to our characters. So you see the war both in how it frames each act and how it mirrors the prompts. And I say the war mirrors the prompts instead of the other way around, because you don't actually get to the war until after the prompts happen. And also how the war is a part of every character, so that you can use the war as a metaphor for connecting with other people and for pushing yourself to engage with someone intimately. Because maybe you don't want to tell someone that you have burning passion for them, but maybe you can tell them, Reggie, why don't you sit down after the war? Like, I can hear it in your lungs right now, and that really worries me. Sit down. Why don't I get you a cup of coffee?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Totally. Can you talk about, I mean, you're talking about using the war as like the text and then making romance subtext beneath it there in the example that you gave.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm curious to hear you talk about that idea of making the war itself metaphor. And what do you think that looks like?
Okay. So in each act, you have the war is mentioned and it's in a different place, right? So in act one, the war is over. Everyone now has a stable job. Everyone is hopeful and excited, and there are things, and all of the prompts are like that as well, right? Mm-hmm. But everyone has been affected by the war. Some people came to Melton Hall after the war. Some people have worked there forever, but they were affected. James was too sickly, but he has strong political feelings and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I know that guy.
Yeah, right? So
he's me.
So here you are in a situation where you want to connect with other people. You have these feelings for them, but also it's the first act and you don't have necessarily a lot of information to go on about these other people. but you do know that James was too sickly to go to war.
Yeah. Everyone a history. Like, yeah. I feel like that's something that's really tough in character creation kind of across games, mm-hmm. is like establishing history. I think this is a big reason why Apocalypse World says stuff like the game really gets good around six sessions. Mm-hmm. It's because after six sessions, you got history.
Yeah.
You could like play off the history, and shortcutting with this like the war, this like mythic concept that is also rooted in like a ton of real world history that people may be able to pull details from. I mean, almost whether or not those details are accurate, mm-hmm. in no sense doesn't even matter, right? Just the fact that there's all that material for people to pull from allows you to get to history with characters really quickly in exactly the way you're describing.
Yeah, exactly. And what's kind of neat about it is that you can, it's also sort of the shared intimacy, right? We all went through, yeah, the war. So it's possible we've been telling these war stories forever, but we were willing to listen to each other tell these war stories again because,
yeah,
we always have this touchstone with each other. And because the war affected all of us personally, anytime we talk about it, anytime we engage with it, we're engaging with something personal.
Yeah.
Right? And then from there, you can kind of segue your way into something else, making up details about the servants.
This is so good because it feels so reflective of real life, mm-hmm. and how you get to, like, I think a lot about what I would call like 1 a.m. conversations, mm-hmm. where like, I have this vivid memory of, I played a LARP with a bunch of friends, a bunch of people at home, but a few of us were like hanging out. We were visiting in town, so we're like, 4 of us are staying in the same house or whatever. And one of my friends just goes, let's talk about our feelings. And like, and it was like the perfect like thing, right? It was just like, yeah, that is 100% like what I want to do right now. But there was like no lead into it. And I thought I've been thinking, this was nearly a decade ago now, and I still think about like, how do you get to those conversations? Because I know the thing that he wanted to do, and then we did it, and it was great, and I want to do that all the time. And like, how do you get to that point? Mm-hmm. How do you get to like, let's talk about having crushes on each other? Like, the way that you do it is by getting there slowly, I think, or being very clear. Mm-hmm. And like, if you're not going to be very clear, then like having a topic like the war to sort of gradually build up that intimacy, it, again, the way that you were describing, mm-hmm. is so helpful and, yep, such a clear path to, mm-hmm. get you there.
Yeah. And I mean, we all know that war isn't inherently like romantic and that sort of thing. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Obviously, war is terrible. But like, a lot of romance stories take place in terrible situations and settings. Yep. And a lot of it is because those settings push people together. Like, yeah, maybe the situation sucks, but at least you can find comfort in someone else who is, yeah, there right now.
Yeah.
And that shared experience of the horrible thing is kind of what gets you there.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like there's a lot of the setting here, not just in the war, but also in the like, the family is away, mm-hmm. and we are in this like liminal space, mm-hmm. of like the hall without the family, mm-hmm. the place of work without the context of having to do our jobs, and also liminal time of New Year's Eve, like between two things, and also the liminal time of between two wars, right? We're in this like weird ephemeral space and time, and that to me, it feels like such a perfect place to, it feels like those spaces and times like lend themselves to intimacy. And like the war hanging over everything too makes me want to like emotionally like hide under the blankets. And like, I feel like once you do that, that like you're metaphorically like hiding under the blankets with your coworkers and with your crushes, mm-hmm. like that leads to the kind of romance that we're talking about here.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And okay, so the game says that the space you should physically play it in should be large enough that you have a space to sit down and that sort of thing, but that no place is private.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And what I love about that is that instead of people like splitting off and having these private little moments necessary and not engaging really with anyone else, you go off, but people can still see you having a private moment.
Yeah.
And they can give you that space. And so, yeah, not only does it add to everyone else because they're whispering in the corners like, James is talking to Chris, James is talking to Chris.
Perfect.
What do we
gossip
do?
Yeah,
but
yeah, yeah.
Also, it means that you can sort of feel like you've made a special place.
Yeah.
In the space that you're in. And that just feels like really great in the game, because it's, you get that sense of like everything falling away around you and you're just focused in this area.
Yeah. I remember playing a LARP at Big Bad Con in 2019, where we were like in a hotel room that had a balcony that like overlooked the lobby of the hotel kind of thing. And so like mostly everyone's like hanging out and LARPing like in this hotel room, but like 2-3 people at a time could like go out on the balcony and like look over this like beautiful view together. Mm-hmm. And it totally did exactly that. It was this perfect space for that, where you're doing the thing in physical space that you are also doing as characters on a like conceptual level in relationship to war, mm-hmm. right? Of like carving out this little space for yourselves, carving out this moment in time, and then carving out the like literal space for yourself on this little balcony, mm-hmm. even if it means everyone gets to watch you do it.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, people talk about immersion sometimes, like you have to add all of the set dressing, but I have played this game where the walls of the room was just like plastic strung up, and the room was too large and the lighting was too harsh, and I had like 2 folding tables.
Yeah.
And that those were the props that I had in this space. And at the end of it, everyone came out of it like, that was the most romantic story I've ever had. Oh, I had such wonderful feelings about it. So yeah, I really love this game. So
I feel like that match of theme of like finding romance in a hard, carving out a romantic space for yourself. Maybe that's not theme, but that's like a thing that the game wants to be about, and then is literally the action that it is asking you to do. And it is providing you like all of these mechanical and flavorful like jumping off points to then take that action. And I feel like that's just good game design. Mm-hmm. That's what good game design is finding the like right walls, the right jumping off points for you to do the action that the game cares about you doing.
Yeah, and it does it very minimally. Like
the
cards don't have that much text on them, thank goodness, because I'm getting older and it's harder to read stuff. And I mean, I love a lot of the tools that people like make on their character sheets, and they're beautiful, and I can't read half of them anymore. And I just...
Yeah. I've always had this problem. I have good eyesight, and I'm just like, I don't want to read your small text.
Right?
It looks ugly. I want to read the big text.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sanguis populi, the blood of the people, the dark protectors of the hidden city of Azeroth. Deep within the illusory forest, familiar with death as they have eluded it, they are called upon for a desperate task, slaying a creature from the great beyond. Blythe.
This might not be easy, being surrounded by death. I don't understand how they can do it.
Elvira.
Someone must watch the bodies. And none do so as diligently.
Swan.
Into action so fast. I love when we get to go out.
It came from the sky. This great, pale monstrosity.
You just had to sate your hunger. You couldn't have saved it for the beasts.
I prefer the gratuity.
Vampirism is not immortality. It only prolongs the inevitable. Is this the end for Sanguis Populi? Blood in the snow. A tale yet told. Halloween 2025.
Sorceress, lower the barrier for just a moment. Sanguis Populi departs.
Listen to Tale Is Yet Told wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode of Dice Exploder is sponsored by Hero Forge. Hero Forge offers fully customizable tabletop miniatures with dozens of fantasy species and thousands of parts to choose from, all within your browser. And these minis come in a variety of materials, including bronze, color standees, and color plastic options, or Download model files for your minis and 3D print their unique designs right in your own home. HeroForge also has custom printed dice where they'll stick your favorite mini floating inside a die, or put that mini on a keychain. HeroForge custom acrylic keychains are printed at the same scale as the rest of HeroForge minis and arrive already attached to a high quality zinc alloy lobster clasp, so you can take your favorite character wherever you go. HeroForge is constantly expanding its catalog of customization options, adding new parts every week, so check back in and see what you've missed. Visit HeroForge.com to start designing your custom miniature and dice today. This episode of Dice Exploder is brought to you by Die Meta Dungeon. Die Meta Dungeon is a campaign-length, dungeon-based adventure for the Die RPG that is also a crawl through 60 years of tabletop RPG history. In Die Meta Dungeon, your characters will enter a massive dungeon that grows deeper and more dangerous as more people succumb to the honeyed allure of role-playing games. Dungeon crawl your way through every era of gaming, from the 1970s to the present day, one decade per dungeon level. Survive to the end, and you might learn something. For the first time in the Die RPG, player characters will get to return to the real world between levels of the dungeon, trying to juggle their real-life problems, and maybe even apply some of the important things they've learned about themselves in the dungeon, before being drawn inexorably back into the meta dungeon. It's a classic fantasy mega dungeon campaign with a postmodern twist, and at least 6 months of sessions baked into it. Die Meta Dungeon is on BackerKit through April 2026. This episode of Dice Exploder is brought to you by Orbital Blues Month. 1 month, 6 creators, an entire outlaw galaxy to explore. Orbital Blues is an RPG of sad space cowboys where your crew of desperate and downtrodden outlaws travel across a music-infused space western universe filled with retro-future technology plagued by heartbreak and the haunting shadow of the blues. And through the end of April on BackerKit, 6 creators are all running projects that expand the Orbital Blues universe. Check out Outlaws and Corporations from Soul Muppet Publishing, a book filled with NPCs, adventures, and setting inspiration. Formula Infinity from Plus One EXP, a high-octane space racing adventure complete with bespoke mechanics for racing. Or A Fistful of Stars from Stations, an interwoven series of adventures set on an interstellar train line. Or any 3 other projects. Each project also comes with a soundtrack from Behold, which you're listening to part of right now, and which you can get as a limited edition cassette tape when you back multiple projects. Orbital Blues Month through the end of April on BackerKit. Check it out. Okay, so let's talk about the acts and the passage of time and how the war and the romances kind of develop along with it here. Like, if we're taking the thesis here that this game is in large part about using the metaphor of the concept of war hanging over you and bringing that down into the story, how does that concept evolve over the course of play, and what do you think that says about how the romances are intended to evolve over the course of play?
Okay, so in the first act, we have excitement, we have hope, we have joy, we have these burning passions for each other. And in that first act, the war is a thing of the past. It is a thing that affected all of the characters. It is a thing that they still carry elements of in their lives. And it's a way for them to sort of connect, rather for the players to connect with their characters and with each other as they sort of feel out these relationships and explore these relationships and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And we have a limited time. Players aren't necessarily aware of how long 45 minutes feels like yet. And then whatever you're using as the ending happens, conversations get cut off. People gather and they sing Auld Lang Syne, or they shout Happy New Year, and they, you know, every game that I've run, without prompting, everyone has been like, oh, it's time to do a farewell thing, which is really great. It's not written into the game or anything, but everyone feels the urge to do that, which is wonderful.
We all have that cultural tradition.
Exactly. And it's a great way to sort of like end the act, which is fantastic. And then there's a time jump. And the next act, the characters have uncertain feelings of some kind, or they have questions. And the players don't know how they got there, why they have these feelings over the years, what's changed over the years. And in a longer game, you would be inclined to play to find out on how to get there, right? Like, you would go through the whole thing and all the in-between bits. But it... in fanfic, we call this just getting to the good part. So you skip all the intervening bit and you're like, okay, fine. Yeah. Yes, I'm sure lots of things happen. But the good part is that now I'm having these changed feelings. And in the same way, the war is now, there's this uncertainty going on. So you can now use the war, oh, things are changing overseas, that sort of thing, as a new metaphor for how did my feelings change?
Yeah.
And what am I going to do about it? Am I going to do anything about it?
I like the way that this naturally mirrors how a new relationship works, where you like show up and it's like, I love this person and like all my problems are solved and the world is good now. Mm-hmm. And then like you get 6 months into it or whatever, that like new glow wears off, or you get 4 years into it, you know, like mm-hmm. that's how long the act jumps are. And it's like, oh yeah, that the world is still happening. Like my problems have not gone away. Like now we have to bring some of that reality back into things.
And like trying to explain how all of the intervening time between wars and all of the different things that happen to get from one war to another is like basically impossible. Anytime I have to read up on the world wars, I have to do it all over again because there's just too much. Yeah. Right. And in the same way, this time jump allows the players to be like, you know what? I had like a one minute conversation with this one player, but I'm going to point this question or this feeling at them because I want to explore that more. And you don't have to find the meandering way through a game to sort of figure out how to get there. You can just be there and do it. And everyone will just sort of hand wave it away as well. 4 years went by.
Yeah.
Sure. This is kind of where we're at.
Well, it lets you hand wave away that stuff, or you can dig into it together, right? And like I love the way like Andor season 2 was doing this thing of like every 3 episodes we just like drop into the story again for a few days and then we'd skip ahead another year, and like it's up to you to just kind of like keep going. And like there are interesting reveals you can do with like, oh, I don't like you now, and like, or we're having tension in our relationship and we don't know quite what that's about, but like one of us is going to like publicly get really mad at the other and like bring the secret out that happened 2 years ago or something, right? Like that kind of play is really fun and really exciting to find together.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. So Act 2 is always like really, really interesting because it gives everyone a chance to sort of explore around and feel things around and discover new things, right? And then Act 3 happens and it's these questions. And these questions hit hard. Like, would you fight for what you believe in? Should we have children together? Are you strong enough? What does that mean? And then you're told the war is literally coming. We're not here anymore. Like, this is your last night. It's the last act of the game. This is all the time that you have left. And it puts the characters in a position of thinking about their future instead of looking at the past and how they got there. Right?
Yeah.
It matters to some extent, but now they're trying to feel out what the future has in store for them. And this part isn't like necessarily the romance side of things, but it is interesting. Pip is the youngest character. He starts off 16. He's, I think, the hall boy, which means that when the next war comes around, he's the right age to enlist.
Yeah.
So half of the game, like half of the time, is about everyone asking him if he's going to enlist and being worried about Pip.
Yeah.
Which is also really interesting because like often, well, maybe not often. In a lot of the games I've played and run, Pip might start a little bit of a romance and might play around with it, but doesn't often get like a strong romance for the future kind of thing necessarily. Like, Pip's young. He's playing around. He's learning some stuff. People are like, oh, you're a bit young for me kind of thing, right?
100%.
But in Act 3, he gets like all of the attention and all of that intimacy. And it might not be romantic, but there have been as many tears cried over Pip as anyone else in this game.
Yeah.
Yeah, and like the need to make a decision and to make a choice for the future is basically what Act 3 is all about.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, this game really seems to have endings on its mind. And I think it is smart in that it understands that like endings aren't the end of life until they are. Mm-hmm. But like you're starting out at the end of a great war, you're also like starting with a bunch of like failed romances and people's backstories. I like really noted that as I was reading through all the characters. Mm-hmm. And you're ending up at this place where like the hall is closing down. Like there are all these questions pointing towards like, is our relationship going to survive like the next couple of years? Like it feels like all of this is in question. And then also we're like going out into this world that's going to keep going and keep doing the world war and everything that comes after it. And I feel like that is it feels to me like an interesting and so much more realistic thing to like put in conversation with like rom-coms, you know, or like most romances were like, and then they ended up together and like, that's the end of the story. Like it's so much more complicated here while still being about like where these relationships end up.
Yeah. I think it also gives, it tells the players, hey, this doesn't have to be the romance. Like once you start something, yeah. You don't have to like hit the end of it. Your character can experiment around. Your character can like choose to do certain things. One of the really subtle things about this, well, it's not subtle, it's pretty explicit in some places, is the underlying queerness of the whole thing. Graham, in an interview, said that he really wanted to portray queerness the way that people at the time might have portrayed it. And so not like, this is my identity, I'm a lesbian, I'm a something. It's, no, this is what I do. These are my behaviors. And the labels aren't actually the thing we care about. It's who we do them with and what we do that is sort of the focus. And because of that, players don't have to get so hung up on playing the lesbian cook or whatever. It's just like, no, I prefer women. That's fine. Or I would like someone to be comfortable with. And, you know, it'd be nice if they didn't bother me for sex too much. That'd be cool.
Yeah, I think it's really helpful to give people like action to play there rather than identity to play. That's kind of what you were saying, but I just kind of wanted to like underline it, right?
Yeah,
like it's much easier to say like, this is the thing that I'm looking for. Or like, the, you know, with James again, like, yeah, I get paid to sleep with men and women and I'm looking for someone to settle down with maybe. Like I have a goal there more than I have an identity that's really helpful as a player.
Yeah. And I mean, even if James at the end never gets his like romance or whatever, right? Like,
yeah,
at least, I mean, he's got a fallback. He might like sleep around for money as well, or he might be like, hey, I'm really good friends with things. Like there have definitely been games where people were like, yeah, we're gonna rent a house in the countryside and we're just besties and that's great.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, yeah. That's great. Well, okay. Do you have anything else to say about the game? Like, do you have concluding thoughts? What feels important to you to wrap up with?
I think this game asks you to bring a lot to the table, but it makes it really easy for you to bring it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like,
absolutely.
I once had someone come out of a game and tell me, yeah, this is a really great game, but you have to be an expert role player. And I was like a little confused. I'm like, really? She's like, yeah, because you have to make up all of these things and you have to be comfortable talking with people and making stuff up with them and having that trust with them immediately and improvising and all this stuff. And I had never felt that way about this game. And I mean, I don't know how to qualify what an expert role player is, so that was never my feeling on the game. But yeah, I think the way it paves, the way it lets you bring things forward and gives you tools to sort of like work things in, like the war is a metaphor, this immediate connection with everyone. I think the ease with which you can just dive into the game really speaks to the design that goes into it.
Yeah. This feels like another great like conclusion episode to my LARP series, honestly, because I feel like this is like pulling in so many threads and like executing on so many things that I love about this kind of LARP. Like it's such a tight game. I think that line you said about like this game is asking you to bring a lot, but it makes it really easy for you to bring it. That is like what I want from games and like why I like this size of LARP in particular, because I think like LARP more than tabletop asks you to bring a lot, and like this size of LARP is often doing a really good job of giving you exactly the right amount to pick up and run with. And yeah, I can't wait to get this game to, I guess not the table, to the ballroom, as it were.
You absolutely should. My advice, if you're running it, because it doesn't really say, it just says have some props. What I found works really, really well is that you definitely want a room that is large enough where you could have two largest groups having different discussions.
Yeah.
Right. But about that size. So you can have the groups sort of split in half. The other thing that I would suggest is think about a little bit about sound. I started every act with a song from the era, which I actually got from Graham. And then, like I said, I ended with the grandfather clock going. And every once in a while, as soon as you introduce a song at the beginning of the act, everyone will be like, oh, let's go put on some music. So you better have a playlist just in case. Someone will be like, do we have a record? I'm like, shit.
Yeah.
So that's a thing.
That's a great example of, I did this episode with Carol Murphy about experience design. Mm-hmm. And we talked a little bit in there about like doing just a little bit, like how to bring just a little bit of like set design, like a little bit of like, like extraness to the thing. Like I went to Big Bad Con last year and Jason Morningstar was just like running around whenever he's running games. He would just like bring out his little bag full of hats. Right. And everyone would get a hat. And like, that's like nice to just add a little bit of extra. Mm-hmm. And this game feels like a great showcase for the power of that. There's a lot of really easy, just a little bit that you can add to otherwise a living room or whatever and make it feel just a little bit more. And that'll go a long way, I think.
Yeah. Definitely. I don't know if you want to talk about this. I was thinking about Rosenstrasse because I'm also obsessed with Rosenstrasse.
Sure.
And how that is.
I have not read Rosenstrasse for reference. I know what it's about, but can you tell me what Rosenstrasse is about?
So Rosenstrasse is about German women and their Jewish husbands during the rise of the Nazi regime in Berlin, the erosion of their rights and freedoms throughout that time. And it culminates in the husbands being taken away because they're Jewish. And the Rosenstrasse protest, which was a very real protest that happened, where all the women went to the Rosenstrasse facility and they had a protest and said, give us our husbands back. And they got their husbands back.
Hmm.
So Rosenstrasse is a game about all of these terrible things that are happening to these people, as well as their relationships and the love and intimacy that they have for each other and with each other while all of this is happening. Mm-hmm. Will That Be All is a game where there is a war, and it's a part of the game, and I would call that a romance game. I would never call Rosenstrasse a romance game, except that there is so much romance in it.
Yeah.
There's so much intimacy, and so many of the scenes are designed so that you can have those intimate and romantic moments, but I still wouldn't call it a romance game.
Yeah. Right? What would you call it instead?
I would definitely call it a game of intimacy. I would call it a game of love. I would call it a game of resistance.
Yeah.
But I think a romance game. Okay. In fiction, a romance needs a happy ending, right? Hmm. And technically, Rosenstrasse has a happy ending, but I feel like there's a wishful thinking that's missing from Rosenstrasse. Right? Mm-hmm. That exists in Will That Be All. And in both of those cases, the setting details are chosen to sort of support what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm. I would also say that in Rosenstrasse, the thing that is at stake in the story is not the like commitment to the relationship from any party involved. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, the relationship might be at stake because of external factors, but it's not at stake because of internal factors. And that, to me, is what makes a romance game, is, like, as characters, do we want to be in this romance? Like, that's the thing that feels like it is romantic to me, is trying to answer that question when there are challenges.
I feel like somewhere there is somebody with a master's thesis who's like, let me tell you about the romance genre and all of the, because that sounds like a romance thesis, like or a master's thesis about romance.
That's just,
because like,
you need a screenwriter. Like, I don't know.
Right. Like, yes, I agree. In a lot of ways, I feel like to say that the relationships in Rosenstrasse aren't the central stake is like not true. This is especially true of a particularly challenging couple that exists, which I'm not going to spoil for you, but it's one of the more difficult relationships to manage. But it's really interesting to sort of see what things in a setting help craft the space for romance.
Yeah.
And what things allow intimacy to flourish, but isn't really a romance sort of thing, right?
Yeah.
I don't have a fancy conclusion to this. I was just thinking about it. So.
Yeah. I would say, maybe to conclude here, I think the last thing that I would say about this game is how much it feels like a safe way to explore some contemporary feelings in a historical time.
Mm-hmm.
Of feeling like there is the cloud of uncertainty and war and future disaster hanging over the world, and still trying to explore not just how you feel about that, but how you feel about your personal relationships and what you're going to do with your life in the meantime.
Because, mm-hmm. Yeah, as much as we would like to believe that all the bad times are over, I think we have
They're
seen
not.
The news. I've seen the news.
I live in Los Angeles. You know, yeah, yesterday, as we record this, it's June 8th. And yesterday, you know, ICE went to war with a community an hour and a half from my home. And, yeah. You know, it's just happening. So,
yeah.
Okay, but on that note, I am really excited to play this game.
Yes.
I can't wait to play it. Thank you so much for bringing it to me and bringing it on the show. It was such a delight to have you.
It was wonderful being here. Thanks for letting me talk wildly about a game that I absolutely love.
Thanks again to Kim for being here. You can find her on Blue Sky at Lady Lakira. Thanks to everyone who supports Dice Exploder on Patreon. As always, you can find me on Blue Sky at Dice Exploder or on the Dice Exploder Discord. And you can find my games at sdunnewald.itch.io. Our logo is designed by Spore Garee. Our theme song is Sunset Bridge by Purely Gray. And our ad music is Lily Pads by my boy, Travis Tesmer. And thanks to you for listening. See you next time.